This is Kimberly Smith speaking to you on behalf of the Christian Management Association. The Christian Management Association is pleased to bring you the two keynote addresses delivered at the Copyright Seminar held in November 1986, where the topic for the seminar was The Effects of the Australian Copyright Laws on the Christian Community. The two speakers were Mr. Murray Baird, Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Laws from Monash University. Mr. Baird is the senior partner of the legal firm Moores Solicitors. The other speaker is Mr. Cameron McCauley, who is a barrister practising in copyright laws in Melbourne. I'm now introducing Murray Baird, a solicitor, the senior partner of the legal firm of Moores, and Murray's about to address us now on the topic of copyright. So over to you, Murray.
Thanks, Kim. Could I hand out an outline of the things we'll be talking about so you know where we're going and you can take notes as we go along? And can I tell you about the evening services at St Cuthbert's at Surrey Park? Because at St Cuthbert's they're really up to date and their evening services are very modern. For example, as you enter the church at 6:45, there's modern Christian music playing through the sound system. The recording convener has an excellent set of EVI tapes, and he brings them along to the service and puts them through the sound system through his tape recorder. And the service itself starts with a song service, and the songs are always modern and up to date because the church, in fact, have a loose leaf folder for every member of the congregation. And when a good song comes up, they photocopy it and they put it into that folder so they're always up to date on what happens. In fact, someone photocopies those at work and provides them to the congregation free of charge. If they can't get the songs copied in time, if this fellow's not going into work, they're able to put the words up on an overhead projector, and so the congregation can read straight from the screen. And that way, really, the songs are completely up to date and they can really have the latest. You can understand that the vicar is very keen to have the gospel as relevant as possible to the congregation and as up to date as possible. And so the church invested in a large video screen, and the vicar is able to tape segments from the television during the week that he thinks are relevant to the congregation, sometimes parts of a newsreel, sometimes parts of a television program that point out some things he wants to say, and he puts them on the video screen during the service to bring home the relevance of the gospel to his congregation. At other times he takes clippings from the newspaper or Time magazine and he makes a collage of those so that people have something to concentrate on either during a prayer time or during the sermon to bring home again the relevance of what's happening around the world. The youth choir are terrific. They often get the latest songs from tapes from the US, and if they can't get the sheet music, one of their transposers takes that music from the tape, writes it out so that every member of the youth choir can have a copy of it. The vicar likes to use a modern translation of the Bible, but unfortunately the Pew Bibles are authorised version. So what he does is he photocopies segments from the Bible that the reading comes from, and he slips them inside the church bulletin for that week so that people always have the text in front of them as he preaches. The services are taped, and there's a strong demand for these tapes for the shut-in folk of the congregation, and a strong demand for mail order as he sends out the sermons and the songs to people who are interested in what he had to say that week. That tape includes the musical items and the Bible reading. And here's what the vicar says. We could never have brought our services so much up to date without the help of modern technologies such as videotape, overhead projectors, cassette tapes and photocopiers. It is an integral part of our witness to the community. In recent years, the church Christian community have found that it's not quite as easy as those people at St Cuthbert's would have us believe, because there is property involved in all those uses of other people's material. Surprisingly, copyright in the Bible, or at least the translation of the Bible that he's using, copyright in the songs that are sung, copyright in the newspaper articles, copyright in those words that are put up on the overhead projector. Why has there been such a recent interest in this area of law? 10 years ago, it wasn't of a great concern to a church congregation or a Christian organisation. It didn't often impinge on our activities. And I suggest that the reason for that is the widespread and the inexpensive and convenient methods of copying that have come into everyone's hands in recent years. For example, the almost universal presence of the photocopier in the business office makes it easier to create a document with the photocopier than to purchase the original of that document from its creator. And audio and video records have also become widespread and convenient for copying. But there's been recent publicity about breaches of copyright law, and there have been prosecutions of some who have broken these laws. That has included schools and churches. So today we intend to give some broad guidelines concerning the nature of copyright law and some practical ways of meeting responsibilities under the copyright law. We're very happy for you to set your own agenda. If there are issues that you've come across in your organisation or your congregation, don't hesitate to come into the discussion at any time with questions, and also recount any of your experiences that are relevant to the issues as we get to them. So don't hesitate to interrupt. Why should we really worry about copyright laws? I'd suggest three reasons. The first, we need to recognise the originality in a published work is the property of its creators. It's in the same way, perhaps, as a handcrafted piece of furniture is the property of its creator. The person who creates is entitled to receive fair compensation for his efforts. And if creative writers and musicians are to continue their work, it's fair, I suggest, that they should be paid. Secondly, as leaders of Christian organisations, we must ensure that we use proper and lawful methods. There must be integrity in all of our activities and our example. And thirdly, the penalties for breach of copyright are severe, and paying a substantial fine or damages may not only be a financial burden which would limit our ministries, but it would also damage the reputation not only of our organisation or of our church, but of Christian witness in general. I was discussing with Cameron earlier what the penalties for breach of copyright laws are, and it's interesting that we find them under the piracy provisions of the Copyright Act. So the law looks at certain breaches of a copyright law, or people who breach those areas of law, as pirates. Well, what is copyright? Copyright is the exclusive right to do and authorise others to do in Australia specified acts in relation to works and other subject matter for a limited term. Note that copyright is not a right in a tangible thing. It's a right to do something in relation to that thing. For example, the painting on the wall by Lynn Sharrock there. Lynn has put that painting on the wall there. The canvas and the timber is one aspect of it, and there is property in the canvas and the timber. But there are other property rights in that painting, the copyrights to do things with that painting and to do things with that image. And that's really what we're talking about. Copyright isn't concerned about the ownership of a piece of paper. It's concerned more about the words that are written on that paper or the creative ideas that are expressed on that paper. The same with a painting. We're not interested in the canvas or the frame. We're interested in the ideas expressed in the painting itself. One corollary of this is that if you should buy a painting, you don't buy the copyright in that painting. So you can't publish that in your book or magazine. That remains with the creator of the painting. Now, this concept of a right to do something rather than the materials themselves may be a bit esoteric and could perhaps be best left to lawyers. Perhaps like the blind men who found that it was easier to talk about aspects of the elephant than really tell you what the elephant was itself, we could talk about some examples of material that's protected by copyright. And I should say, perhaps, that everything you want to know about copyright is recorded in the Copyright Act. It's a Commonwealth Act of Parliament. You don't have to go to the law books as much as to go back to the Act and read through it, and there are some checklists in the Act of Parliament that will assist you in learning what the parameters of copyright law are. There's also a note there that copyright lasts for a specific time. Copyright isn't an indefinite thing, it's fixed by the Act of Parliament for a specific period, and we'll go into that later on. The Copyright Act protects the following kinds of material. There are two categories. One is works, and the other is everything else, or subject matter other than works. And the works are original literary works, such as novels, poetry, articles, short stories, textbooks, and handbooks. Literary should be read really as printed matter, rather than of any specific quality of style or expression. Thus, a football fixture has been held to be a literary work in this sense. A train timetable would be a literary work. So it doesn't have to be well written. Dramatic works, such as plays, film strips and choreographed shows. Musical works, including words and music for hymns and songs. Artistic works, including photographs, cartoons, paintings, sculptures, banners, or other artistic craft work. And then to take some examples from subject matter other than works, films, which would include videotape film and as well as cinematograph films, and sound recordings, being records, tapes, cassettes, etc., and television and radio broadcasts. The only reason that these are divided into two categories for the purposes of our discussion today is that the Act deals with these categories differently. You only really need to be aware that there are those couple of categories, works and matters other than works, and realise that some different rules are applied to them. It's interesting that one of the categories, and I haven't mentioned it there, of subject matter other than works is a published edition of a work. For example, if I took an ancient book or a book that was out of copyright, and I brought out a new edition of that book and typesetted in a different way than it had been set before, that would attract fresh copyright. So if you... we'll take an example. If I took a Dickens book and I found the original of it and I photocopied it, I would not be breaching copyright. The copyright has expired. And the copyright would have expired 50 years after the year, the expiration of the year in which Charles Dickens died. But if I then typeset that book and republish it, and someone else photocopies it, they would be breaching my copyright in my typesetting. Protection under Australian copyright laws is automatic at the creation of that work. It's not necessary for any registration to be affected. In fact, there are no official facilities for registering copyright in Australia. There are some free enterprise registration offices where you can lodge a document and they will date stamp it, and then if at a later date you need evidence that you created that document on a certain date, you can go to them and they will give you the evidence. But that is not in itself registration. It's only an evidentiary thing and could be achieved really by dating that original work and on your say-so that it was created on a certain date. Usually the author or creator of the material owns the copyright and owns it automatically once that work has been created. There are some exceptions to that rule. The work of journalists would be an exception. Photographs, portraits and engravings made on commission. So if I were to commission you to paint a painting of me, and it was agreed that I would own the copyright, as your brush hit the canvas, I would own that work. Employment contracts and agreements providing otherwise. The owner of a copyright in a sound recording is usually the person who owns the material, such as the disc or tape, and this is usually the recording company. Now, in the absence of any other agreement, Timbertop Studios would own the sounds of my voice on that tape, because it's their tape at this stage. And in the case of a film, the producer is usually the copyright owner of the film. In the case of a broadcast, the broadcaster. Thus, if a question arises in your dealings as to who owns the copyright, it would be wise to seek specific advice in that situation, or at least to go to the Copyright Act and look for that specific situation to occur in one of the lists and find how that would be interpreted. Copyright is like any other piece of property. It can be transferred, and the usual way to transfer it is by way of an agreement, a contract to give certain rights in a work. And you can split up the property into some acts that a person could perform, you could hold back some rights to yourself. You might give a person the right to print your work in a book, but you may not give them the right to make it into a film. Infringement of copyright. The usual ways in which copyright can be infringed are as follows. I think you've got them on the outline in front of you there. I should, perhaps before I go on to that, mention the C in a circle. Most people will have seen the C in the circle, and I've said that copyright is automatic. There's nothing magic that you have to do to create copyright apart from create the work itself. The C in a circle is the result of an international convention, which isn't directly applicable if you only want copyright in Australia. But if you were to create something which you wish to have copyrighted internationally and in America, it would be necessary to put the C in the circle and the name of the copyright owner and the year of the first publication in a prominent place on that publication. And the traditional place that it's put is on a page near the front. And an example of that, you've no doubt seen in books. that's the copyright wording on the screen of a major copyright text. It's got the C in the circle, it's got the name of the publisher, Butterworth Proprietary Limited, and it's got the year that it was first published. So to secure an international copyright, it is essential to put that on any material. The wording that comes after that, this book is copyright apart from any fair dealing for the purposes of private study, research, criticism or review, as permitted under the Copyright Act. No part may be reproduced by any process without written permission. Inquiry should be addressed to the publishers. It's just a piece of gratuitous advice. There's nothing legal about that. Butterworth, the publishers in that publication, just feel that they want to give you a bit of advice on the law.
That's not necessary, Murray.
Not necessary, but it may be a fairly good deterrent if an amateur were coming to your works and planning to copy it. It might scare them off.
Also, you're talking about international stuff there.
Yeah.
Is that applicable to Australia now? You don't need that. You still copyright.
Now, if you wanted copyright in Australia, the very creation of your work would create that copyright. But if you felt it was going to go overseas, particularly to the United States, it would be essential to have that notation, that first notation, the C in the circle, the name of the owner of the copyright, and the year of first publication, when you first published that work. Now, a little known provision in the Copyright Act is a provision that says that if you create something that will be library material, you should lodge that within 1 month of the publication with the National Library, and you should send it off to them for their cataloguing. What is a piece of library material? It would certainly be a book. It would probably be a monograph, but your church bulletin, I don't think, would be really required for library material. So you've got to decide where you would draw the line. If you're really in doubt, it might be worth ringing the National Library. Owen, have you had any experience there?
We send on the...
So a periodical magazine, you send it each month, and do they send you back the number that they've used to register that?
No, I don't think so.
Right, and you don't publish that number in your periodical?
We have an ISSS number, yes.
Right. Now, infringements of copyright. This can be looked at from two sides of the coin. What are you entitled to do if you own the copyright? On the other hand, what are you entitled, what are you not to do if you don't own the copyright or you don't have permission? And the infringements would be reproducing the work, publishing the work, performing the work in public, broadcasting the work, cause the work to be transmitted to subscribers through subscribers to a diffusion service, to make an adaption of the work, to include the work in a television broadcast, and to make a copy of a sound recording, to cause the recording to be heard in public, to broadcast the recording, to make a copy of a film, to cause the film to be seen in public or the soundtrack of a film to be heard in public, to broadcast a film, or to cause the film to be transmitted to subscribers to a diffusion service. I understand a diffusion service is a cable TV, but Cameron may know whether that goes wider than that.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
Right, it should go through a cable to come in that category. It's a simple checklist of the things you can't do, and I think it just about covers the lot. So, again, you find it in the Act, and you can look it up if you have a situation where you've got concern as to material. But generally, any material that you don't own, whatever you do with it, is probably a breach of copyright unless there's a specific exception. And Cameron's going to go through those exceptions later, such as certain photocopying provisions and fair dealing provisions, which allow an apparent breach of copyright to be defended if you have good reason to.
Are you dealing with performing public as it applies, say, to a church and a service?
Yes. Yeah. There'll be specific... generally, a performance would be a breach of the owner's copyright in that work or in that musical work. But... Cameron will be going into the details of what the implications for that are in a worship service, and there are some concessions there.
We'll be touching on the use of quotations in speeches and sermons, taking out illustration out of a book. Is that useful, not permissible?
Right. We would go into that under the fair dealing discussion.
Substantiality of the reproduction.
So Cameron will discuss if you take just a quote in the context of another, an essay or a sermon or whatever, that's fair enough. But if you take great wads of someone else's material, you step over the line, and somewhere you've got to determine where that line is. And if you get it in the wrong place, you may be prosecuted by the owner. But we will cover that specific exception.
Even without it, with acknowledgement?
Yes, if it were a substantial part, it doesn't matter whether you acknowledge it, you should seek permission. So perhaps we might go on to the area of seeking permission. And based on that general premise that if you're using someone else's material, the rule of thumb is that you should get permission. Find out who the copyright owner is. In a book you'll find that on the front page, normally, as you'll see in the example we've had. Songs and hymns may include that detail under the specific song, or it may have a separate page at the front of the hymn book giving you the names of the copyright owners. A film will record the owner of the copyright on the credits, normally at the end. A record or tape will have that set out on the label. And you need to write to the copyright owner seeking permission for that specific use. And in your letter, you should include the following matters, and I've set those out in the outline: the title, author, and publisher of the publication from which you wish to copy, and its date of publication, which specific parts of that work you want to copy, and give them the page numbers, it makes it easier for everyone, how many copies you intend to make, what you will do with the copies, will they be sold, will they be used many times over a long period, will they be used only once, will they be sent overseas, and who will use them. For example, recently a church was having a Sunday school anniversary, and they wanted to run a tape off of the children singing the songs to sell to the parents at a nominal price, a cost price. It was necessary for them to write to each of the publisher's representatives for each of those songs, tell them specifically how many tapes would be made and how they would be distributed and what the cost would be, and then the agent wrote back and gave them a price of so many cents per cassette that should be sent in to pay for that recording right. Now, if we're talking in terms of performance, a dramatic work, permission should be sought from the publisher. It's been made a bit easier by the fact that publishers have got together and appointed an agent in Australia who deals with most musical works from the point of view of performance, and that's the Australasian Performing Right Association. And it's an association of copyright owners authorised to give permission for certain performances. And generally, if it's a musical work and you want to perform it, you should write off to APRA and give them those details and seek permission. The association's long-standing policy with respect to performances of music taking place during the course of church services is that such a licence is granted free of charge unless the performance fulfils some subsidiary entertainment function or performances occur at the church in a context other than that of religious worship. For example, there might be some doubt as to whether singing those songs in the Sunday school hall would be covered by that normal exemption for worship services, and any church would be wise to apply to APRA for a licence to cover recitals and other similar events taking place outside of the context of religious worship. When I last applied for such a licence, the fee was $25, and it covered that church for all performances, one-off performances, really, such as the children singing songs in the Sunday school hall. If you were going to put on a major musical work, you would, of course, have to go to the publisher or to go back to APRA and talk to them about a specific work. For example, putting on a full musical. APRA then distributes those few dollars that you send them out to the owners of the music, and they work that out on a percentage basis based on the returns that come in from major performers. So they're not really worried about you putting a return on every song that is then performed in your church during the year, but they would go to someone who is putting on a lot of performances and ask them to fill out a return, and then they would work out the percentages the composers were entitled to from that survey of the proportions of music being used. APRA don't act for some Christian music organisations, and you would generally find that if APRA wrote back and said that they didn't handle a specific musical work, that Word Music could probably direct you in the right direction. So you could drop a line to Word up in Heathmont. It comes as... Have we got anyone from the Bible Society here today? No. Right. Well, it comes as a surprise to many people that even the Bible is copyright. And that's to say that most of the translations normally used in churches are still subject to copyright. The Bible Society holds copyright on the Good News Bible, and permission is necessary to reproduce the text and line drawings also from that translation. In most circumstances, permission is readily given, and it's a matter of writing to the National Administrator of the Bible Society at Post Office Box 507, Canberra City. And you should again set out a checklist of the way that you're going to use that work, the church or organisation, the name and the nature of the publication in which the material will be used, the scripture passage required and illustrations if relevant, the format, will you be doing it in a book or a folder or a leaflet or on a tape, whether the publication is going to be handed out free or not for profit or on a profit basis, and how many copies you intend to produce. Most modern translations, you should follow that procedure. Look up the name of the copyright owner in the front of that translation and get permission if you're going to publish it to any extent. That's subject to the fair dealing provisions that Cameron will discuss. So it would be appropriate in a paper or a sermon to quote verses if it was, to the observer, a fair way to use that quotation. Perhaps we could take up some of the specific problems that people will be concerned with. Cameron, could you tackle some of those, and then we'd throw it open for other specific problem areas that people have?
I wonder whether it being nearly 22, I could... There's perhaps a few points arising from Murray's paper that it, perhaps I could comment on, and then if you, we could take a natural break there, and I'll start after that. And just as Murray's been speaking, I've jotted down a few things which occur to me. I'm sure Murray won't mind me coming in on them. The St. Cuthbert's scenario that Murray opened with sounds very much to me like an exam type question that one gets in a copyright paper, which raises all the thorny issues that might or might not arise in a particular fact situation. And it was a very, very detailed and complex scenario, and I'd hate to have to unravel that in an exam type situation in a copyright subject. But it does highlight some of the simple day-to-day areas in which the lurking copyright infringement may exist. And on the one hand, we ought to be vigilant, but on the other hand, we ought not to be too paranoid, lest we find that we're crippled in our activities altogether. But certainly, it's essential that our eyes be open to what our obligations are. Yes, the copyright law is to be found in the Copyright Act. I don't know that I'd recommend too many people to try and read it, because it is a very, very complex piece of legislation, but it is necessary to refer to that to find the precise formulations of exclusive rights, exemptions and the like. But typical legal fashion, almost every simple word that exists in the Act is the subject of being pulled apart in certain cases. A simple word like performance or public or reproduction, these words have been pulled apart and analysed in cases, and it really is quite a complex area. And the other difficult aspect to the Copyright Act is I think that there's 249 sections, and the frustrating thing about it is you read section 40 and you think you've got the answer to it, and then you read section 84, which says subject to section 40, or section 40 is subject to this section, and you thought you'd had the answer when you read section 40, but in fact it's cross-referenced all over the Act. So there are a few traps, not just for young players but for old players as well, in reading the Copyright Act. So unless you are very confident in that particular area, it would well be worthwhile seeking at least confirmation, if not initial advice, when looking at the Copyright Act yourself. As to infringement and what the remedies in existence are for somebody whose copyright work is infringed, there are civil remedies in the Act, which means a copyright owner has a remedy against a copyright infringer and can bring that person into court and obtain damages, injunctions and other sorts of remedies. Murray referred to the piracy provisions. There are also, in addition to the civil remedies, some criminal or quasi-criminal type of penalties under the Act, which means if basically designed to catch importers and manufacturers of infringing copies, when the importing or the sale or the manufacture of that infringing copy is done with knowledge that it is an infringing copy. And it, of course, is attended by the normal, for any criminal offence, one must have mens rea or guilty mind, and one has to have that proven against you. So there is a distinction between a civil infringement and a criminal infringement, although sometimes it might just be a matter of degree and how much knowledge you had at the time when that particular infringing act took place. Lawyers are very cagey. They tend to say, oh, well, it all depends on the particular facts, and won't give you a straight answer. In defence of lawyers, that's because it does all depend on the facts in many various situations, and the difficulty in saying whether reproducing two or three pages out of a 100-page book or reproducing a paragraph quotation in a sermon is or is not an infringement, it really is a matter of degree, and it's a matter of the facts. So frustrating though that answer may be, is just the truth of the matter, and may be able to help to some small degree when I talk about substantiality or substantial, what substantial means under the Act after our break. It's an interesting, the definition of library material, when Murray referred to the obligation to deliver to the National Library, within a month after publication. Any library material. Library material means a book, periodical, newspaper, pamphlet, sheet of letterpress, sheet of music, map, plan, chart or table, being a literary, dramatic or musical artistic work or an edition of such work, and so on. You can see that on the face of it, it's a very, very broad definition. One, I suppose, needs to use a little bit of common sense in respect of that. Murray's just published a, well, what would you call it, pamphlet, distributed today.
Yeah, I've sent it off to the library this morning. Yeah. But I left out the C in the circle, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, he won't be subject to the penalty of $100, which flows from not doing that. But that is, in fact, it's a penalty of $100 for failing to do that. But you can see that one needs to exercise a bit of common sense and not become paranoid about the existence of these, of that particular, for instance, that particular obligation. But at the same time, being armed with that knowledge, if you produce in your church or organisation a manual which is published in a book or reasonably substantial pamphlet form, say it's bound and it's distributed quite widely, you may need to give consideration or seek advice as to your obligations in respect of delivering that to the library.
It's an obligation, it's not just a...
It's not just an optional. No, it's when the word shall is used in legislation, that's a mandatory obligation, and the word shall is used in that particular provision, and there's a penalty provided if you fail to do so. Having said that, there no doubt is a discretion, a very wide discretion, from any prosecuting authority under the Copyright Act, prosecuting any copyright infringement, and where an organisation ought to know and is publishing things all the time and ought to know about their obligations, they may well be prosecuted. But normally any prosecuting authority in something like this would simply say, if it came to their attention, did you know that that was your obligation? Now you know, we're certainly not going to prosecute you, but in future we'll give you some guidelines that that sort of thing ought to be delivered to the library. I've never heard of anyone being prosecuted for it, perhaps Owen might know more about that, but there'd be more of an educational motivation behind educating the community, informing them their obligations, rather than a heavy-handed penalty or prosecution.
An academic thesis.
Sorry?
What about academic thesis?
Yes, well, an academic thesis, I think, would fall within that. Yes. Where a licence is obtained from APRA, for instance, that Murray referred to, that, of course, is an acknowledgement of the existence of copyright in the material that you've used. It doesn't then give a general exemption to use that material elsewhere other than in the particular worship service or environment that you've sought the permission to use it in. So if you obtain it for use A, you can't go and use it in use B. It doesn't confer a general license upon you.
You're listening to Side 2 of the Seminar on Copyright Laws, sponsored by the Christian Management Association. You're about to hear the address by Mr. Cameron McCauley, a Melbourne barrister.
What I will look at is, in short, looking at the at performance as a specific use of works, and in particular performance in the context of worship services. I'll touch on, or I'll look particularly in respect to hymns and music in the worship context. Now I'm going to look just briefly at photocopying as a specific form of copying and what particular legislative provisions exist in relation to that, which you know you may wish to bear in mind. Performance in public is one of the exclusive rights attached to copyright work. It's defined fairly broadly in the Copyright Act, and without going into the whole definition, as including a reference to any mode of visual or oral presentation, whether the presentation is by the operation of wireless telegraphy apparatus, by the exhibition of cinematograph film, by the use of a record, or by any other means, and B, interestingly, in relation to a lecture, address, speech, or sermon, be read as including a deliverance, as a reference to delivery. So, in respect, with respect to a sermon, that may constitute performance. The delivery of a sermon itself may constitute the performance of some copyright work. But it's not simply performance, it's performance in public, which is the exclusive right. And it's engaged the courts to some degree as to what in public exactly means, performance in public. There used to be an old distinction of private, public, or domestic stroke public, and the courts tried to analyse whether it was performance in public by reference and by contrasting it to a private or a domestic type of performance. And that got a bit difficult when you got, I think in England earlier in the century, a sort of mothers' society that met during the week and invited people to come along and paid a nominal price, but it was very much just at the home of some of the members, and certain copyright works were performed, were sung in that sort of context, and it was very difficult to work out exactly whether you called that domestic, private, or public, or just how it was to be looked at. There was a recent case of a motel which piped video broadcast or video tapes through to televisions in private motel rooms, where individuals or individual couples using the motel in the privacy, so to speak, of their own motel room would watch this videotape. That was held to be a performance in public. The critical question seems to be, does the audience watching, listening to, observing the presentation, does that audience constitute a part of the copyright owner's audience? Now that may seem to be a roundabout way of answering the question, but are the people who are listening to or watching the particular presentation the sort of people who the copyright author would consider his or her audience if they were to commercially sell their product? So, let's say in the context of the motel room, were the people watching the video on the TV in the motel room, would they form part of the original videotape owner's public? And the court said, well, yes, they did. They would be the sort of persons who would ordinarily go out and purchase such a tape. And if it's simply piped through to their rooms, then that was an infringement of the copyright by the motel owner. Now, it need not be, contrary to some belief, a performance in public. To be a performance in public, it need not be paid for by the audience to constitute a performance. There's a case where a car radio shop left its radios on, blaring out into the mall of the particular shopping centre to attract people to their shop to purchase their radios. Well, a member of APRA, the Performing Rights Association, people were snooping around and they heard this and brought those people to court, and they were held to have infringed the music that was coming through the radios, the copyright in the music that was coming through the radios and being bled into the shopping centre without paying appropriate royalties because they had performed that music in public. Now, obviously the people walking past and into the shop weren't paying for the privilege of hearing that, but it was nonetheless a performance in public. Now, subject matter which may be performed, literary works may be performed by the delivery of a lecture or of a sermon. Dramatic work may be performed by the reading of a play or the presentation of the reading of a poem or the presentation of a play. Musical works, of course, can be performed by the singing of the words and the music which constitute it. Now, there is an exemption where performance of a literary, dramatic or musical work is conducted in a class by a teacher in the course of giving educational instruction, not being instruction given for profit. It's later said that the mere fact that the teacher is paid by the organisation doesn't mean that it's for profit. But so there is a limited exception where a particular literary, dramatic or musical work is performed in an educational type of environment. Now, educational institution is defined fairly narrowly under the Act as being institutions which are either schools or specifically or primarily educational institutions, and query whether a Sunday school would fall within that category. In fact, from material which I will refer to shortly, it's unlikely that a Sunday school does in fact fall into that category. But certainly if you're involved in Christian schools or Christian educational organisations specifically, there may be for the teachers in such environments an exemption from the performance. But the most interesting thing as far as we're concerned is the performance in a worship service. Now, there's a recent government committee set up to look at the use of copyright material by churches. And a committee, as I say, was put out a discussion paper, and that attracted submissions from all sorts of Christian organisations representing the users on the one hand, the churches and organisations, and the authors on the other hand, being Christian writers, songwriters, musicians and the like, who made various submissions to this committee. The reason for the committee was to see whether there should be some general or specific exemptions given to churches under the Copyright Act. And broadly, the answer was no, there shouldn't be. We should leave it as it is, and the churches should be subject to the same laws as everybody else. I'll just read a couple of paragraphs from the discussion paper, and this is in respect to the church's representations. It quickly became apparent to the subcommittee that the main concern of religious copyright users centred around the use of music in services of worship and associated church activities. There are two distinct copyright problems in regard to the use of music in services of worship. First, if music is copied, either by photocopy, printing, or by overhead projector transparency, an infringement of the copyright owner's rights takes place, unless his approval to this action has been given and certain other conditions have been complied with. Recently, it says, a US court awarded damages of $3.2 million against a church for copyright infringement of this nature. It may well have been on a much larger scale than we're accustomed to. Second, although the committee knows of no legal decision directly in point, it is of the opinion that the actual performance of a work in a service of worship, for example, the singing of a hymn, is probably a public performance for the purposes of the act, and as such has to be licensed. So that was the gratuitous opinion of the committee, which was after representations by various organisations were made. They then put out a report and followed up that initial discussion paper by saying in that report as follows. In its discussion paper, the committee expressed the view that the performance of a copyright musical work in the course of a service of religious worship is probably a performance in public of the work within the meaning of the act. Although the question is not free from doubt, the committee adheres to its original view. So you can see that even amongst experts, and this report was written by Mr. Justice Shepherd, a judge who is known as an expert in the field of copyright, so he was expressing some doubts but thought that it probably was, fell into the category of performance. Goes on to say, no issue aroused more concern and at times emotion than the issue of performance. There is no doubt that many of those who represent the church feel that there is something inherently wrong in the idea that a hymn or other religious song cannot be sung or played in church without the permission of the copyright owner. And many of us may well identify with those feelings. A majority of the committee is, however, of the view that because no special case for treatment of the churches has been made out, there is no warrant for a legislative intervention to create an exemption from liability in relation to the right of public performance. Public performance right is, under the Act, only one of several exclusive rights conferred upon the copyright owner, mentions another number of others, and has traditionally been an integral part of the author's copyright. It would be wrong in principle, in the majority's view, to effectively exclude it as a right under an author's control in relation to a sector of the community which has not made out a case for special treatment. The committee was concerned that there are Christian musicians, Christian songwriters who make a living by creating and selling their product, and that in particular, if churches were granted a special exemption from liability in exploiting, if that's not too harsh a word, those products in their worship services, then that really hurts a particular sector of the community who's trying to eke out its living. And the church didn't satisfy the committee that any special legislative protection was warranted.
Is that saying that purchase of a hymn book does not give you the right to use the hymn publicly?
Well, that's right. It's just like Murray was saying, that the purchase of that painting purchases for you the materials in that painting, but it then doesn't confer upon you the right to do one of the exclusive, to perform any of the other exclusive rights, such as to reproduce it in a material form.
Ostensibly, you wouldn't buy a hymn book if you weren't going to use it to sing from.
Well, you wouldn't buy a hymn book if you weren't going to sing from it, but you may buy a hymn book without publicly performing it. Right?
Unlikely to be.
Well, if you were sitting around in a you know, with the piano at home and playing it, that is a use which is not a performance in public. Whereas what the committee was saying was that it's quite probable that singing in the context of a worship service is a performance in public within the meaning of the act. Now, that's what we're caught with, and it may well be that the author of the hymns intended it to be used in a worship service and would waive any royalties or would waive any infringements of the copyright, but you can't assume that. I think that's the important thing.
Is this publication, which has been put out by the United Church,
yes.
It does state specifically that APRA does not charge any fees for performances that occur solely during the course of worship services.
Right.
I think that
perhaps,
yes.
Except you have to apply for a license for APRA to do it.
Yes. See, the fact that a license, the fact is that APRA doesn't charge for a license, but nonetheless, technically speaking, a license is required because it is an infringement otherwise.
This also would get back to a published work, I assume. For instance, I remember in the article in the newspaper when this came out, I think it was about last January or something or other, there was something to the effect that Onward Christian Soldiers would not be able to perform without being subject to copyright. Now, in fact, Onward Christian Soldiers was written 150 years ago, whatever it happened to be. So in itself, it could be sung, as long as you were, say, singing it from memory and not using a published edition, published later than 63 or whatever the date.
I remember reading that article. I'm not sure that it was necessarily correct in saying that Onward Christian Soldiers couldn't be performed. I'd be surprised if that's correct. It may have been a journalist simply wanting to attract attention. I just don't think that that's necessarily right. But certainly,
I suggest it is wrong that the copyright in Onward Christian Soldiers, the singing of it or the performance right, is owned by the writer of Onward Christian Soldiers. For 50 years after his death, or probably his relatives would get the advantage of that. Mm. But at that point, it's no longer the performance right is gone.
Yes,
and the edition itself.
Well, copyright doesn't subsist in that work,
in the song itself.
Beyond that, yeah.
So really, we're stuck with hymn books that were published we're stuck with hymn books that have got hymns in them that were published more than 50 years ago.
It's not the publication of the hymn book itself. See, the hymn book, this is where it does become fairly complex, and because we're dealing with intangible property and we're trying to split up intangible property, it gets a very difficult mind exercise. But this particular document has a number of copyright rights inherent in it. First of all, there's the right, there's the property in the typeset, the actual printing itself. This is a literary work because it's words in a material form placed upon a page. But there may also be copyright when you're looking at a music book. You've got the copyright in the edition, if it's a published edition, but the copyright in the content of what's on the page, that is the song itself or the music itself, and they could be owned by two separate people. Now, where a song, say, written 100 years ago, is put in a new published edition, then there no longer subsists any copyright in the song itself, because that expired at the end of 50 years after after the songwriter's death. But so you can actually perform that without any difficulties. But what you couldn't do, if the published edition had come into existence, you couldn't photocopy the published edition, because that's a reproduction of something which has been created within, you know, that last 50 years.
Anything published before 1936 would have to be okay in itself, because the songs have to be written before then. So they're at least 50 years old.
So well, it's the author's life plus 50 years, just to get it technically correct, but basically the idea is right. Say if the author, it was published in 1936, the author died in 1950, then in the year 2000, you'd be right. To perform, or to do any of the exclusive rights in relation to that work.
Mm. stuck with the ancient, if it was King Book or the old, with the Anglican's use.
Well, probably not. For $25, you just get a license to have the situation. I think that would be the simple answer.
Does this mean that every church has to get a license?
The committee did discuss the idea of denominations generally being able to obtain licences, but preferred the idea of individual parishes doing it for one reason or another, which I won't go into. But that seemed to be the decision of the committee, or the recommendation. I don't know exactly what force that has, but. That there was a recommendation that there be some statutory inclusion to allow whole denominations just to get a blanket license, but I think the committee must have decided that that's just too broad, that it wouldn't enable proper supervision of whether the licences are being complied with.
If you pay that $25 for a licence to use in place of worship hymns, would you have to specify a particular hymn book and pay the $25 for every particular song book or hymn book that you're using?
No, I don't think so, no.
It's a blanket thing across the
board. Yes. Perhaps if I read from the committee's report on that, it says... a blanket licence is available from APRA upon request. APRA is the Australian Performing Rights Association. APRA does not currently charge a fee for performances in services of worship, but does charge an overall fee of about $30 or $25 a year with inflation if performances occur at related public functions such as fetes or socials or the like. So there's a bit of a contrast between performances in your service of worship and a performance which may occur, say, in the at a fete, or which may occur at at a play which you put on in your hall and charge admission for. And it goes on just to give the rationale of that decision not to create an exemption in favour of the church. A majority of the commission does not believe that music copyright owners should lose their performance right in this area. Certainly, there it is. Sorry. The majority of the committee does not believe that music copyright owners should lose their performance right in this area merely because they have to date waived the right of payment. But that tends to be the case, that to date they have waived their right of payment.
Cameron, excuse me, there is the sort of the understanding, isn't there, that if the producers of a hymn book, and I was involved in this kind of thing, have paid copyright fees to the owner of the copyright, that therefore you are free to use the hymns. But apparently you're not.
Well, you are then...
to write to APRA.
No. See, APRA is just a conglomerate of musicians. What musicians have done, and performers in Australia have done, is they've said it's too difficult to locate us individually, everyone who wants to use my song. What we'll do is we'll form an association and we will all make that association our agent for the purposes of licensing the use of our works. Now, I think that there's some percentage that's estimated as the number of musicians and performers in Australia that have conferred such agency upon APRA, and it's, I think, close to 80 or 90%. So there's a small percentage who are outside of that, and APRA would be able to tell you whether those persons have. But once APRA has licensed you on behalf of the performer to perform, publish, reproduce, or whatever, the work of that performer, then you have a license to do so. You've paid for it. It's a contractual thing that entitles you to do it.
So my church should write to APRA and pay a fee for using the hymn book?
Well, that's what we're suggesting, yes. The parishes, individually...
Oh, no church in Australia has done.
Well, I don't think...
Me, my client, so...
No, I don't think that's quite right. Many parishes, in fact, do that.
Could I ask the question, we're talking music, what about, say, in the Anglican Church, where you've got a prayer book, and every Sunday, you know, fairly consistently, a priest would be reading exactly from that, almost publicly performing the service of, say, Holy Communion.
what's the situation there?
Well, I think technically that would be a performance in public of the literary work, namely the prayer book. And again, it may seem ludicrous to suggest that a prayer book would be, and it probably is ludicrous to suggest that the prayer book is printed and disseminated to churches without it being intended that the prayers be recited publicly and performed publicly. So there may be an implied waiver of copyright by reason of that. What the committee is saying is that in relation to music specifically, it cannot be assumed that there is an implied waiver in the copyright vested in the authors simply because it's put into a hymn book form.
Australian hymn writers and things, you know, if you get an overseas hymn book, do you go through APRA or do you have to go elsewhere to be able to use it in church and things?
Well, generally overseas hymn book, any overseas, would have the publisher in any event written in the book itself, and they might be your first port of call. But I think APRA would be your first port of call in any event.
APRA have agreements around the world, and if you obtain an APRA licence, you could perform foreign songs.
Right, well, that's the answer to that.
On the question of the prayer book, in my view, there would be an implied licence because it's so obvious that the church has distributed that book for that specific purpose. For example, the cases are when I write a letter to the editor of the paper, there's an implied license to publish my letter. I would have thought that when the denomination distributed that book, there's an implied license to perform. But we note specifically that in hymns it's been found that there's not.
Perhaps, let's say I'm a radical vicar and I want to move away from the prayer book and I want to copy slabs of that onto a printed form of service, and I'll use a fair bit of the authorised prayer book, but I'll put in some of my other material. Is there any problem there? I form a new church for the purpose too. And
well, there may be an implied licence to perform in the sense of recite the prayers from the prayer book, but there may not be any implied license to reproduce it, to photocopy it. In fact, I doubt whether there would be, because perhaps commercially speaking, the publishers of that document, the prayer book, would feel quite rightly that commercially they've lost.
So if I'm a vicar and I want to run a children's service in a few weeks' time, and I want to produce a little order of service for the congregation, a few prayers for them to follow, would I need to seek some permission?
Well, there is a requirement that the reproduction of any particular copyright document has got to be to a substantial degree. So we then get into discussion of what does substantial mean within the Act, and perhaps I'll go on to reproduction now. But before I do, there is just one thing of some interest under the Copyright Act, section 106, where in relation to sound recordings, where a sound recording is caused to be heard in public as part of the activities of a organisation, the principal objects of which are charitable or concerned with the advancement of religion, the act of causing the sound recording to be heard in public, this does not constitute an infringement of the copyright in the recording. So what that means is that if you have a a tape, a sound recording, and you play that in your church organisation, then it is not an infringement of the sound recording. But that may not help, because it could be an infringement of the music which is on the sound recording. And whilst the Act confers an exemption for in respect of the sound recording itself, it doesn't unfortunately confer an exemption in relation to the music.
How does that relate to background music for audio visuals?
If you hire an audio visual or something?
No, if I produce one, which I do.
Oh, if you produce them?
You need some background music.
Right, well, yes.
He's on with Christian Soul Systems.
Well, there's a few other angles, but... can you use a tape?
That could be an infringement in those circumstances. I used to work with a performer, and he produced for his performances, he was a mime artist, tapes. Musical tapes, just taken off records, and then would perform in public with that as background music. Now, that technically would be an infringement of the copyright in the music, unless he had obtained permission to use that. And I think the situation you're describing would technically fall into the same category. Although you wouldn't be performing it, there might be... You'd be reproducing it.
But then you're showing the audio visual. Mm.
Yeah, when you show the audio visual, you're performing it. When you actually tape it, you're reproducing it. So there'd be two infringements. we may go on, but that's the technical answer to that question.
What about then, which is what I've done, is to produce my own recordings of music at times.
With live musicians?
Yeah, from a concert.
You then become the copyright owner in that sound recording.
Yeah.
That's the first
music
step. In respect to the music that is performed, musicians who are publicly performing it ought to have permission from the authors of the music. And if they don't, they could be technically in trouble. And presumably, if you reproduce their performance of that, I query whether you could possibly be in breach of that too. Never ending. But all we're doing is highlighting the technical aspects of the act. It is. It does have a great impact, technically, on these sorts of things. Happily, no one, or rarely do people bother to enforce that. Rarely are even authors themselves aware. But occasionally you do get the author who's aware that their musical work has been performed without them getting the royalty check. And they get annoyed and they send off a letter or get someone to kick up a bit of a stink. Once your fingers are burnt, of course, you know a bit more in the future what to be aware of. But,
some books or packets of overhead transparencies for hymns and choruses and so on, I thought had implicit authority to perform those or to put them on the screen and sing from them.
Some of them may. In fact, they're probably printed on the document itself. But this may be, used without permission or whatever. And wherever you see that, then you're right. In the absence of that, just let small alarm bells ring.
There's a further question about particularly about songs, which in the Christian subculture tend to circulate fairly freely.
Yeah.
And by the time they come through 18 churches, you've no idea who the author was, who the copyright holder is, what the original words were, or what the tune was. you inherit a version of it.
Yeah.
What do you do then? You don't have a clue who made it or wrote it owns it.
Well, that's a very real practical problem, and I think the committee actually referred to that, talked about the... folk song type tradition within churches and the difficulties that creates. Didn't really have an answer to that except to say I think generally that you know, you do what you can, and if you meet with brick walls, then you just adopt a common sense approach to it. So I can't really sort of give a special answer to that.
What is done by those people who publish editions and use those folk songs is that they indicate in the front piece to their book that they're doing their best to find everyone, and if anyone can help them, would they help out? And they hold back in effectively a trust fund a percentage of their profits, so that when that person turns up, they'll be able to distribute. So they keep their consciences clear, and I think they'd have a pretty good defence if someone pulled them up. They would say, we did our best, we retained a sum of money, what more can we do? And I would suggest that's the practical approach for anyone, not necessarily holding back any monies, but saying, we'll do our best to find the source. If it's anonymous, if we can't find it, we're willing to meet our responsibilities when that person turns up. And that would be the best way to avoid punishment.
On the same line, the gentleman here on the team mentioned where they were putting on a particular cantata, and they had a certain number of books, but not enough to go around, and they approached the distributors, and they did not have any more. Now, his problem is having copied them. Is he an infringement of the copyright? That probably he is. But because the publishers aren't able to provide him, does he have some defence?
It would be best to write to the publisher and offer to meet the royalty on each number of copies. So you would write to Novelli or to Allens or whoever published the cantata and say, we propose to perform at Easter. We do not have sufficient copies. Are we permitted to photocopy 10 extra copies, and could you advise us of the royalty requirements?
Now, there's just one other little detail about that.
Yes.
It's possible that copies will be available in a fortnight's time. In the meantime, we have copied in order to continue preparation, and we're prepared to buy the new copies.
Well, always the best way is to come clean with them and say, here's what we propose to do. We will buy. Do we have your permission to photocopy in the interim? Or just to pay royalty straight out so that we keep our photocopies and don't bother you again?
Now, we'll move on just with the material that we have to cover, and then perhaps we can return to some further questions. There's a helpful and important exemption, which is called fair dealing for purpose of research or study. And this relates to, perhaps if it might be helpful if I can just read some of the provisions of the Act. A fair dealing with a literary, dramatic, musical or artistic work, or with an adaptation, for the purpose of research or study, does not constitute an infringement of the copyright in the work. So that's the principle, and then it goes on to try and help us work out what a fair dealing for research or study is. But the principle is a fair dealing in respect of one of those works for the purpose of research or study is not an infringement. So that's not a license or anything, it just simply says it's not an infringement. For the purposes of the Act, the matters to which regard shall be had in determining whether a dealing of a work, blah blah blah, is a fair dealing, includes as follows: the purpose and character of the dealing, the nature of the work, the possibility of obtaining the work or adaptation within a reasonable time at an ordinary commercial price. So obviously if it's for the purpose of research and study and you cannot obtain it at a reasonable time for a commercial price, reasonable commercial price, that will be a factor to be taken into account as to whether you have, by for instance photocopying a book which is out of print and you want to use it for the purpose of research or study, then that may be a fair dealing with it. The effect of the dealing upon the potential market for or the value of that work, and in a case where part only of the work is copied, the amount and substantiality of the part copied taken in relation to the whole work. Now, we obviously don't have time to sort of go through all of those particular things, but say in your organisation, if you wanted to together consider a somebody's work on a particular point, might be an academic work, and there was three or four pages out of a book, the book wasn't readily available, you were having a particular study on that topic and you wanted you just couldn't find that book anywhere, and you're only using three or four pages and you wanted to photocopy it and disseminate it amongst the half dozen members of your study group or research unit, that may constitute in those circumstances a fair dealing, and would not be an infringement of the Act to have done so.
Excuse me, can you use a limit as to how much you can copy in that aspect?
Is there a limit in number of pages or percentage of the whole? In educational institutions, there's a particular limit specified under the Act in recent amendments, but if you're not an educational institution, then you would come within this provision, the general provision, and it just talks about the amount and substantiality. So unfortunately it doesn't give any percentages to help us.
Within the educational system, is there not?
In educational system there is a there's a fairly detailed new amendment which talks which gives a there is a licensing, a statutory licensing scheme where if you photocopy more than 1% of the total number of pages in any additional work, or make more than 2 pages of a particular work, then beyond that you are required to start keeping records. And I'd have to sort of look through that fairly carefully again just to be able to tell you what the scheme of things are. But if you are an educational institution and you want to know what your obligations are, my advice would be to specifically seek the advice of a lawyer or the Copyright Tribunal, I think, that might be able to help you there. But there is a special provision of which many educational institutions aren't currently aware and are becoming aware, because I think it's the tribunal or some other official branch of the government is now making people aware of.
Okay.